The global mental health care gap between what is needed and what is available is well known and growing larger by the day owing to COVID-19. While demand for mental health care rapidly grows, services are being cut or diminished because of physical distancing and poorly prepared healthcare systems. Digital psychiatry, in the form of easy-to-access smartphone apps, is being touted as one potential solution, but gaps in research and oversight are hindering progress. We'll have that story and more coming up. From the Lancet Psychiatry in New York, I'm Dustin Graham. Stay with us. Digital psychiatry holds a lot of potential, as researchers in the field like to point out. The sheer number of smartphones in people's pockets, combined with the ease of wide-scale software dissemination, makes digital solutions for mental health delivery an appealing approach. But the evidence for efficacy and safety at this point is far from clear. On the line to discuss this is Dr. Murali Doraswamy, professor of psychiatry and medicine at Duke University School of Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
To get started, could you outline for us where you think we are at currently with our knowledge of mental health applications, or I'll just call them mental health apps for short, and what do you see as the main gaps in our understanding?
I think the recent 2 months of the COVID epidemic have shown how valuable and critical mental health apps can be. You know, in the past, they were a nice-to-have kind of thing on your phone, but now I think everyone considers this to be part of our critical health infrastructure. So it's really, really important that they meet two criteria. One is we have to know that the apps that we are downloading are efficacious and are safe. And the second is we want to make sure they're well integrated into the clinical workflow. In other words, that our doctors who are treating us for various symptoms are familiar with what information these apps are providing to us, and that it fits with not only their workflow, but also these apps are effective in the long run in the real world. It's not enough for it to be proven efficacious in a strict clinical trial setting. And I think there is a lot of evidence, at least with the first generation of apps, suggesting that a lot of these app developers just simply introduced these apps and they didn't really focus on building the evidence base needed. So for example, a review done maybe a year ago of 73 mental health apps designed to treat a range of conditions found that all of them used really scientifically sounding language, but only two of them actually cited high quality randomized clinical trial evidence to support the value and effectiveness of these apps. And even more disturbing, another review of apps to help people in a crisis, like people who are suicidal or in other kinds of crisis, found that a lot of them gave either non-existent or inaccurate crisis hotline numbers. And these apps were downloaded more than 2 million times, suggesting that there could be a safety risk there as well, not just a lack of efficacy. And then last but not least, very few apps are really embedded with the clinical workflow systems, whether it be in the UK, whether it be in Africa, or whether it be in the US. And so what information the patient's getting from these apps oftentimes are not shared with their doctors in an easy, ready, continuous manner. And oftentimes the doctor doesn't supervise these apps. So there's a lot of confusion between what's a wealth and a wellness app, what's a toy, versus what's a serious medical grade app that's intended to help a disease.
A smartphone app is quite different from a traditional pill or face-to-face psychological intervention. Are there any differences or unique challenges in trying to build a strong evidence base for mental health apps compared to more traditional interventions?
There are a number of differences. The good news is that with apps, it's possible to recruit people very quickly. Like many studies of apps have recruited thousands, if not tens of thousands, or even hundreds of thousands of people. So it's an order of magnitude easier to enroll people. But that also brings with it a variety of other issues. So let's start first with informed consent. When you do informed consent in a clinical trial in a clinic, you know, a person is having a discussion with the doctor or with the study nurse, You're going over a 10-page form in detail about all of the issues, the risks of the drug, the privacy issues, who has access to your data, what are you, where do you go if you suffer a side effect, etc. Whereas with the app, you know, a lot of people think of like the consent form for an app, like the terms of service. They just scroll through it without reading and then just click, and they don't know where their data is going. So this is one big issue. How do we make sure that people read and understand, and how do we make sure every app maker doing trials uses a consent form that really gives people all of the information they need? So that's one. I think the second issue is the barrier to entry is very low for an app, which is good. But if they're doing a research study, how does a regulatory body determine the quality of the manufacturer? With a big pharmaceutical company, they can go to the factory, they can do a good manufacturing practice inspection of the factory where the pills are being produced, and they can issue citations if something is problematic. But with software developers, it's impossible to know who's released the app. So regulatory bodies are struggling as to how to ensure quality control of the software developer. The third thing is, when you do online trials, the dropout rate is very high. Unlike real-world trials where the patients are coming to the clinic every week, every 3 months, every 4 months, so there's a lot of human contact, there's phone calls. With software, you know, the first 1 or 2 weeks, everybody's eager, but then you could go from 1,000 people to like 200 people in the second week of the trial. So one of the ways to avoid that is to have a hybrid trial where there's a lot of human contact and engagement, or you provide continuous feedback to people about how their symptoms are improving, so on and so forth. And I would say the last issue with clinical trials is when you do a software trial, when you launch the software in the market, the software version that you use to do the clinical trials may be very different. It may be software version 1.0, but by 3 years, you have sort of both the hardware and the software are now software version 3.0 and hardware version 3.0. So how do you ensure they remain compatible, and how do you ensure that the efficacy fidelity is maintained as the hardware and software sort of constantly evolves? And so that kind of iterative efficacy and iterative quality control is what is needed in software trials.
And what about data privacy, especially in countries like the US where rules and regulations are not particularly strict? Digital technology tends to move quite quickly. So are we potentially moving too fast without first having better safeguards for data protection and data use transparency?
This is a major issue. I believe we are at a tipping point in terms of privacy where if we don't act soon, we're going to have some serious consequences. You know, tech companies by and large don't follow the patient privacy rules that doctors do. And so they sort of have steered clear of dealing with patients for the most part, but as they're getting more and more into patients, studies have shown that all of the health apps are leaking information. And many of these apps make it impossible to even opt out. And even if you do opt out, they find ways to circumvent that by using your GPS or your Wi-Fi coordinates, et cetera. So I think we really need transparency. We need to put privacy back in the hands of the users. Users need to be given a firm way to opt out. And if they say opt out, companies should not try to circumvent it. I think a public-private body needs to come together to really develop ironclad privacy rules. And I wish the US would really follow Europe and some other countries that have very high standards of privacy.
Previous technologies have been developed that people hoped or even claimed would revolutionize mental health diagnosis and treatment. But even after significant investment of money and time, these revolutions still have not been realized in the clinic. Why is this different? Why should we think digital psychiatry and mental health apps will be any different? What's the case to be made?
The simple case to be made is found in your pocket or on your wrist. 2.7 billion people around the world have a smartphone. Health happens in between a doctor's visit. It doesn't happen just when you go see a doctor. If we want to change people's behaviors, if we want to nip symptoms of depression in the bud before they really flare up and put a person's life at risk, the only way to do it is if we can use some of these newer technologies, such as digital tools, sensors, apps, to allow people to monitor themselves and take charge of their health.
All right. Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Dr. Doraiswamy.
Such a pleasure.
Dr. Doraiswamy, along with Dr. Josh Gordon, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, recently published a piece on digital psychiatry in the World Economic Forum. Be sure to check it out. And in other news, while most headlines are focusing on public mental health during the COVID-19 pandemic, it's critical that our attention remains on those who are most at risk for suffering. A new editorial just published in The Lancet Psychiatry explores this issue and the importance of focusing on vulnerable populations during challenging times. You can find that on our homepage. And lastly, Dr. Lade Smith, psychiatrist and editorial board member at The Lancet Psychiatry, recently spoke with Andre Tomlin from The Mental Elf about the importance of including the voices of ethnic minority mental health staff in any surveys being done on the impact of COVID-19 and mental health care. You can listen to that interview on The Mental Elf's website. That's it for this episode. Tune in again to hear the latest news and views on mental health from around the world. From the entire editorial team at The Lancet Psychiatry, thanks for listening and stay safe.